Welcome to our breakfast session. For those who think they're here for breakfast, you're actually here for the media values panel. And but you can, of course, go ahead and enjoy your breakfast. And hopefully this will be entertaining as well as educational. So the panel is on media ethics. Of course, media affects our mores, politics, behavior, values. But what affects and how what runs the values and ethics of those who are running the media and in the media? So to address this, we have a panel, a small panel, because it could be very interactive in the new media sense, moderated by a man who has actually been at all aspects of the media. He has taught children's issues, civil rights, civil liberties at Stanford for almost 20 years. He's written a book on children and media. He has founded two organizations, Children Now and the one that's which is still going, but now Common Sense Media. And he's been an entrepreneur with JP Kids that he started and ran. So please welcome Jim Steuer.
Thank you, Charlie. Okay, so Charlie is right. We really want this to be a very interactive session. And there is a third panelist who we believe will show up and join myself and my colleague, Zeke Emanuel. And I'm going to introduce Zeke for a second and then introduce the topic and then really open it up to the audience. So because Zeke is really my colleague in this discussion that began here initially at the Aspen Institute a year ago. Zeke is a specialist, a doctor of oncology, and he is also the head of medical and bioethics at the National Institutes of Health. And if you look in your packet, you will see an incredibly impressive resume. And a year ago, we were both here at the Aspen Institute running Socrates seminars. Mine was on the impact of media on young people in America, and Zeke was running one on medical and bioethics. And we went out to lunch, and he was describing the field. I was asking him to describe the field of medical and bioethics to me, and he gave me sort of the overview of that, which I hope he will give a very brief overview of today. And I said, well, I work in the media world, and I'm unaware if there is any field of ethics in the media world. So why wouldn't we look at constructing some broad framework in which those who work in the media and entertainment industry, broadly defined, would in fact have their have an ethical and framework in which to conduct their operations. And that is sort of the genesis of the discussion we're having here today. And we've done a fair amount of work in the past 9 months on it. And we'd like to sort of open it up to you today to get your thoughts and opinions. And we have a number of extremely well-qualified people here to join us in that. I want to start by asking you all, I'm going to give you a little quiz, because this is the lens through which I view the whole idea of the role and impact of media in this society and the concept of media ethics. So it's a three-question quiz, and if anybody gets the exact right answers, I will grade you on a curve like I do all my students at Stanford. There will be a great grand prize. So here's just three very simple questions. For me, this is how the whole subject of media ethics is framed. Again, through the prism, the lens of young people. So the first question, you're on the honor system here, is how much time in one day does the average American youngster spend consuming media? Media is defined as movies, TV, video games, music, books, websites. So I'm going to ask three questions, and then
how do you define youngsters?
8 to 18 years old. How much time in one day does the average youngster, 8 to 18 in the U.S., spend consuming media? And this does not include time spent in school. So if they're using the internet in school or reading books in school or watching a video, that would not count. I will give you the multitasking answer as a separate. It's a very good point, Charlie, and I will give that answer as sort of 1B. But so first question is just how much time in a day. Question number two is how many commercials in a year? How many commercials in a year do Ariana's two daughters watch on television? No, how many commercials? Actually, they're in this age range. How many commercials in a year does the average American child watch on television alone? So this does not include commercials on radio, built into video games, movies, product placement. This is just sheer TV commercials that the average American kid, again, 8 to 18, watches in a year. And the third question I have for you is, who, it'll be interesting to see if anyone in this audience gets this, who is the chief regulator of the media in the United States? What is the name of the chief regulator of the media in the United States? And for those of you who do not know exactly the position I'm referring to, it is the chair of the Federal Communications Commission. And if people in this room don't know this answer, we're really in trouble. So question number one, who knows the answer to question number one? Who thinks they know how much time? Charlie, it's not fair. Not fair to let Charlie Firestone. What do you think?
6 hours.
6 hours a day. Steve, what would you say?
About 7.
7 hours a day.
4, 5.
Okay. The correct answer is 6 hours, 45 minutes a day. Very good job. Six hours and 45 minutes a day, which if you add it up is 45 minutes a week, which is basically 45 hours a week, which is essentially a full work week plus overtime. By the way, do you know how much time they spend with their parents in a day? Well under the two-hour figure. And much less time than they spend in school. So, in fact, media is their number one occupation. And if you throw in Charlie's point, how much time they spend if you include media multitasking, which for if you have children like I have four, you understand that is they're on the computer listening to their iPod at the same time, and the TV is also on in the background. If you add that up, what do you think it is, Greg? Time in a day, one day. It's actually 8.5 hours a day if you include multitasking. So the idea is simply phenomenal, yes.
So let's reverse it, how much time are they not?
It's almost that. If you put the multitasking, it is number one. They're by far and away their greatest activity while awake. Question number two, did anybody know the answer? Howard, what would you think how many commercials in a year do kids watch on TV alone? A few thousand.
About
19,000. This is a man who's clearly done his homework. Steve, what would you say?
I'd say about 15,000.
James, what would you say back there? 21,000. The correct answer is 40,000. 40,000. All right. And with TiVo. By the way, I could have thrown this one in. What percentage of kids over the age of 8, actually, I'll do it even better, under the age of 2 have a television set of their own in their own bedroom? Under the age of 2. What percentage of children under the age of 2 have a TV set of their own in their own bedroom?
I hope it's zero.
Well, it would be nice if it were zero, Greg, but it is not zero. Anybody want to take a guess? Correct answer is 27%. By the way, not two and under. This is under the age of 2. Yes, from the most recent major data study by the Kaiser Family Foundation about media. That one on toddlers just came out about 3 months ago from Kaiser. All of these are Kaiser Family Foundation statistics. Howard, yeah.
Well, I think the age issue here is very important because probably young kids, if there's a commercial on TV, watch it.
Correct.
As kids get older, we have no idea whether when the commercial. Ooh.
We will come to that in a point because I'm going to actually introduce the other panelists. I just wanted to, and by the way, the number for kids over the age of 8 with a TV set in their own bedroom is 2 out of 3, 66%. And the last question, who is the chief regulator of the media in the United States? How many people actually know the answer? Just put up your hand. Steve. It is not Michael Powell. Michael Powell was here running a Socrates seminar with me earlier this week, and I said, Michael, who I'm very fond of, but who I do not agree on every media issue with, I said, Michael, you are the answer to the trivia question that I ask all the time, is who's the chairman? Because they always go, isn't it Colin Powell's son? If they know anything. No, just one, you know. You thought it was Michael Powell. Does anyone other than Charlie Firestone, who runs the media program at the Aspen Institute, know the name of the chair of the FCC? No. Ariana, do you know the name of the chair of the FCC?
No.
Zeke?
Martin.
Thank you. Kevin Martin.
That's because I flunked that question last year.
Okay. So I gave you that quiz because I view media broadly. And again, when we talk about media ethics here, and this is very important because Steve, for example, teaches a course at George Washington on journalistic ethics. But we want to talk about whether or not there ought to be an ethical framework along the lines of bioethics and medical ethics and legal ethics in the field of media and entertainment broadly defined. And for me, that framework should be defined through the prism of children, because when you think about the amount of time that kids are spending with media and young people are spending in front of screens, listening to tunes and surfing, you have to realize this is a major public health issue in the United States. It impacts sexuality, violence, obesity, ADHD and early brain formation, sexual dysfunction, teen pregnancy, girls' body images, you name it, alcohol and tobacco and substance consumption. So media and entertainment, to Zeke and myself, and I believe also to our colleague Ariana, is a public health issue. And if it is a public health issue, then we need to build an ethical framework by which to evaluate the behavior of those of us who create media for those kids and adults who spend so much time consuming it. So with that, I'd like to briefly introduce our other panelist, my dear friend Ariana Huffington, my friend of more than 15 years, who basically needs no introduction, so I will not actually tell you her background. I will just say, welcome, Ariana Huffington. And I will turn it over to my colleague, Zeke Emanuel.
So, as Jim mentioned, we began thinking about media ethics in the same way that one might think of bioethics or legal ethics or business ethics, which are courses that are regularly taught in professional schools. And if you think about them, one of the things that they all have in common is that there's a sort of aspirational ideal that they're trying to strive to. So if you think about law, you know, the ideal of law is to try to realize justice. And the second thing you realize is that the ideal, or what you're trying to do in that profession, is for someone else. It's never for the professional, right? I'm a doctor. What I'm trying to do is the best health for my patient. A lawyer is trying to do the best for his client. So those are two very important elements. And the third is that you have to separate out, therefore, the interests of the practitioner, the interests of the doctor, the interests of the lawyer, from the actual goal of the profession. And that's very important, because it means that for doctors, making money can't be first compared to taking care of their patients. If you apply that to media, you immediately can see lots of issues and lots of problems. I think journalists since yellow journalism for the last century have been trying to articulate an ethic for themselves. And as Jim said, we wanted to go way beyond journalism, in part because media is much bigger than journalism. And one of the things that happened is we began digging around in the history of media, looking for what their codes were. And it's a very interesting thing. The initial codes were all about payola in the early days of games on TV and radio. And then advertising was a very big thing that codes got circulated around. And then in the early 60s, there was this whole crisis about media led by Newt Minow and his Vast Wasteland speech. But not only that, for those of you who've seen Good Night and Good Luck, there's a major speech there by Edward R. Murrow about the ethics of media. And ironically, with the deregulation during the Reagan years, actually almost all the media outlets basically throw up their hands and say, we're not going to have a code. Every local place should develop a code, which is kind of an absurd idea that, you know, each local television station develops a code of ethics. It sort of defies ethics, because it's not individuals don't have ethics. You have to have ethics that's shared. That's the whole point. We have to give each other reasons for things. But one of the things that Jim and I found was this television code, which I want to read to you because I think it's actually quite remarkable. This is only an extract from it, but it says, television and all who participate in it are jointly accountable to the American public for respect for the special needs of children, for community responsibility, for the advancement of education and culture, for decency and decorum in production, and for propriety in advertising. Program material should enlarge the horizons of the viewer, provide him with wholesome entertainment, afford helpful stimulation, and remind him of the responsibilities which the citizen has towards society. Now, I'm sure Michael Eisner thinks, how quaint, you know? Obviously, some noble guy, but this actually was the television code during the 50s and 60s. And for Jim and I, this struck us as actually pretty amazing. It's contentful, and I think it defines several very important things, which I just want to go over. First, it says that the ideal is several different things. It's not just to entertain you or to use up your time in frivolous activities. It's to educate. It is to entertain, it's to enlighten, and it's also to engage you as a citizen. The second thing it says is it's supposed to appeal to the whole public. Media has a responsibility to the whole public, and in particular, it has a special responsibility to kids. One of the things that brought Jim and I together was this focus on kids in the media. And I actually think that those two elements, the education, entertainment, engagement, and enlightenment, with this particular focus to the whole population, but especially protecting kids, is very good, useful guidance for an ethical set of norms. Now, the first thing that happened when Jim and I began to discuss this is, you know, you can think of a million objections to this, and I'll just list five of them. I'm sure they're on the tip of your tongue. People in the media will always say, we give people just what they want. We don't shape their preferences. You know, we're just here as a blank medium between what they want, and we're just satisfying their needs. Now, this is actually, I find, one of the most funny things that a media person can say, since all their advertisers are on there to try to shape what people want, and don't accept that they're simply blank slates, that in fact they're buying time to change them. And we know that media can profoundly change what people believe. The second is that it's somehow we're just a business, right? We just make money here. That's our only goal. The sort of Calvin Coolidge, the business of America is business, the business of media is business. That's a kind of lame excuse. You go to any business school and they will tell you, you know, just because you're a business doesn't mean you're above, beyond, exclude morality. We don't permit people to run drugs just because it makes them a lot of money. We do have some norms that we apply to business. Ken Lay obviously found that out in spades. The third thing is, you know, we have a First Amendment. And this protects the media, and we can't do anything to interrupt the media. And the First Amendment is obviously critically important, but the fact of the matter is the First Amendment is not there to maximize returns for Rupert Murdoch or NBC or Walt Disney or GE. It's got a purpose, and we hope that they live up to it. And I think here we really do need to think about what the limits are, if there are, to First Amendment freedoms. The fourth is we have this problem of pluralism in America. You know, there are no clear values. Everyone's got different values. This is a very common idea, and therefore we can't have a single ethic. Well, that may be true in general, but part of what pluralism means is that we argue about values, and that same kind of pluralism applies to medicine and law and business, and yet we've been able to carve out some core shared beliefs and argue about others, right? I mean, we're a country that's arguing about stem cell research. That doesn't prevent us from having a sort of bioethical norms that apply to other things. And so there are a lot of objections to this. On the other hand, I think there's also a lot of sort of disquiet about the media and about what the media is doing. I will actually just say one last thing, and that seems to me, if you think about media ethics in the way that I've said for a second, I think it comes, it gives you actually some positive direction. And I'll give one example of an issue which I think is very potent. Many of you may have seen the latest trend towards creating television, cable television channels directed at under 2-year-olds, toddlers and under. This is, you know, there are several of them now, and they've even dragooned in Children's Television Workshop, the Sesame Street people who'd resisted that for many years. Now, that seems to me to be blatantly not just terrible for the future of America, but unethical practice today. It is not good for children, and maybe we can have Howard or others talk about it. It goes against what the American Academy of Pediatrics has said about children, and it seems hard to say that there's a good reason to do it except money. And it doesn't correspond to the sort of special need to protect children. And I would suggest that this notion of media ethics, trying to articulate it, gives you actually some concrete grounds to explain why you think it's bad to do that. and why we should maybe even take action. And, you know, that's something to debate. I'm willing to be sort of provocative about that. In any case, I hope that has given you some idea for how Jim and I have fleshed out the notion of media ethics.
And why don't we let Ariana make an opening remark, completely open up to you guys.
Well, first of all, it's just great to be here with Jim, with whom we've been friends indeed for over 15 years, and with Ezekiel. Like, can I call you with your full name? It's such a great name. You so rarely hear it, whom I had not met until last week in Aspen, but about whom I've been hearing so much, especially from his brother, Ari Emanuel, who happens to be my great friend and agent in Los Angeles. And you may also know that his other brother is Rahm Emanuel, who is running the Congressional Committee. So this is a quite amazing three-brother series. That would make an entire panel on its own. I have a trivial question of my own before I make a few opening remarks. And this is, how do you think that over 50% or under 50% of Aspen Ideas Festival participants know where the Aspen Meadows Reception Center is? Because I asked a lot of people on my way from Pepke. And I'm very glad I found you. You're a well-kept secret. I want to approach the impact of media ethics on children from another angle. Let me first of all say that I have two children, which is my only immediate sort of reason for being an authority on the subject. I have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old. And I've just finished a book that was prompted partly by the impact that the media and our culture is having on them, called On Becoming Fearless, which is about the fear, especially fear of not belonging, of not being approved of not being thin enough or attractive enough, for all these images that the media are bombarding our children with. So in the course of working on this book, I researched a lot the impact of media and the statistics that Jim mentioned, which are quite staggering. And we see indeed that the media have a much greater influence on our children than we as parents have, even if we spend a lot more than 2 hours a day with them. And I also found, especially having to deal with an eating disorder that one of my daughters went through, just how potentially destructive it can be. It's not just a question of we wish our children believe different things or act differently, but it can actually be phenomenally destructive, the images that they're buying in from the media. But putting that aside, and I'm sure we'll discuss it more in the Q&A and the discussion that will follow, I want to approach it from the point of view of the fact that our children are going to be incredibly affected by the policies the grown-ups make for them and on their behalf. And in that instance, there is something about the ethics of the media that is very troubling to me. And this is the assumption, sometimes stated, sometimes unstated, that all media have to do, especially in political presentations, is present on the one hand and on the other hand, as though truth exists somewhere in the middle. Well, the truth is that truth very often does not exist in the middle. It's hiding in the shadows. It's somewhere there. And the pursuit of truth as the paramount quest of the media somehow is not, at the moment, the center of media ethics. And that's what I'd like to bring up as an issue. And let me bring three examples of that. There are no WMD in Iraq, okay? It's not, the jury is out on that. And yet, for how long has this debate been presented as, on the one hand, there are those who believe there are WMD, on the other hand, there are those who don't. There is global warming. The jury is out on that. And yet the debate continues to be presented in the media as there are the scientists who believe there is global warming, and there are the scientists, funded no doubt by a few oil companies, who believe there is no global warming. Or creationism. The jury is out on creationism. No, according to even John McCain here at the Fortune Institute, at the Fortune Aspen Institute conference last week, told us that creationism should be taught in schools. So here are three issues, and we could go on, where we know what the truth is, but the media insist on presenting it as though somehow we don't really know, and we need to continue examining. And these are incredibly important issues. I mean, if you take the WMD issue, the way the media presented the debate in the lead-up to the war, is tragic. It really, when the history of this war, which is going to impact our children so profoundly for generations to come in ways that we cannot even fathom. If you look at the way the media addressed this issue in the lead-up to the war, it is completely irresponsible. Front page, above the fold stories in the New York Times about the existence of aluminum tubes, when knowledge existed at the time, including by other media like the Knight Ridder Company, that this was absolute fabrication. In fact, you mentioned the impact of the media on what the people believe. Well, what else can we say than the fact that over 47% of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein was behind September 11. What was that except the media allowing politicians to go on TV and present information which was absolutely untrue without interrupting them and saying this is not true? So I would like to challenge the notion that truth always lies somewhere in the middle and that the only ethical responsibility of the media is to present on the one hand and on the other and let the viewers make up their minds.
Okay, so Ariana has introduced, in some ways, I think the last point that Ariana made is about the field of journalistic ethics and about, and the construct that we'd like people to speak to that, and Steve teaches a course on that at GW. But we'd also like you to look more broadly. And one of the interesting things raised by that is if we do develop a framework for media ethics that covers the media and entertainment, and I would say technology industry, certainly the online world, broadly defined, would it be, how would it relate to the field of journalism? My real interest is not just to limit this to journalism and the kinds of important issues that Ariana posed, but to look at it more broadly. But as we develop this field, and that is how we look at this, this is a field we think needs to be developed at great universities and communication schools throughout the country. How do you relate the journalism field to the much broader field of media as we see it today and as our young people in the society experience it? Yes, Howard Gardner. Here.
Thanks, yeah. I think I have a way of conceptualizing this.
Howard, this is Howard Gardner, but you should introduce yourself for 1 second, everybody, so they know who you are.
I think I have a way of conceptualizing this, which may be helpful, though I'm sure it'll be controversial. Basically, you have to go back to the progressive era of 100 years ago where certain groups professionalized themselves. And as part of professionalizing themselves, they had schools and licenses and disbarring procedures. And, you know, there were lots of bad things about this. But when you talk about law and medicine, engineering, architecture, higher education, science, that's where we have in mind when we talk about ethics, because that grows out of a guild for which you need to be able to go through various hoops. And at least in principle, you should be expelled if you don't obey the principles of those professions. In studying myself, I've always said that the term of ethical codes is completely voluntary when it comes to, I usually say business and the arts, but I would expand it to sports and politics. This doesn't mean people can't or shouldn't be ethical, but anybody can announce that they're a business person, an athlete, an artist, politician. You can't announce that you're a doctor or a lawyer because you'll get arrested if you get found out. Now, journalism is very interesting because it's an intermediate case. I could call myself a journalist and I wouldn't be arrested, but people do recognize the difference between someone who is a blogger and someone who works for the Washington Post. And
that
when you
line is blurry.
Sure, yeah, no, it may be disappearing. I mean, you know, Murrow was the kind of the high point.
But
because I became a blogger after I was a journalist, but even so, that's something worth discussing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, that's basically my point. So I think the ambition of media is very, very broad. I would want to start with something much narrower, like, you know, advertising for children. But that's how I think about this terrain.
I just want to make a couple of comments. The code that you referred to, Zeke, was the television code from the National Association of Broadcasting.
Correct.
There was actually an antitrust suit by the U.S. government against the code because it limited the amount of advertising. And that they actually won that. Now, why they would bring that suit, I have no idea. But somebody in the Justice Department, when that happened, the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, decided, well, let's just get rid of the code. At that time, they were also facing competition from cable, which was not subject to the same code. And now we see that even more so with internet and all other sources. So as we think about the barriers to getting an effective code, you have that of all the different inputs. Now, one of the worst is the U.S. media going to other places. I mean, other societies are fearful of the American programming more probably than we are of that. And then I just want to mention one other thing, which was Jim was at a conference we did about a year and a half ago in Santa Barbara called Artistic Freedom versus Social Responsibility, looking at the issue that in Hollywood, you would go to Hollywood and say, why did you put this on? Ken Auletta wrote a famous article in the New Yorker in the 90s saying, what won't you do? And, you know, there were different answers, but they often pointed, well, it's the other guy. It's the writers. We can't control. We've got, you know, or the writers would say, well, this is what they want. And in the end, at least my conclusion was that you really had to appeal to everyone's individual conscience and own individual ethic. I mean, everybody has to do this themselves, but I think it's great to have some idea of ethics and maybe have something written down. How you enforce it then gets to another thing.
As a doctor, what you've said is very familiar, right? Each doctor is supposed to do it individually and has to decide these tough cases him or herself, you know, and lots of other cases, you know, that you doctors haven't had the same exact antitrust issues, but there have been issues against the AMA trying to exclude doctors and therefore say they can't practice. But I would say this isn't for individuals alone, because we don't sort of develop our ethics out of nowhere. We are raised in a society, and one of the virtues, I think, certainly in the medical ethics field, of having an articulate ethics and having doctors who, like myself, who focus on it and are able to articulate it, is that people who are on the front line and do this stuff all the day can appeal to something and say, well, someone who spent their, you know, last 10 years thinking about this, this is how they answer that question. And it seems to me the same thing has to happen in media ethics. If we have a sort of statement which is contentful, not vacuous, it's something that someone who's struggling with an issue can appeal to. And not only that, when they get in a battle with their boss, they can appeal to it for their boss and say, listen, you're violating the norms. And I think actually that's one of the great things about having an articulate statement. I know the history of that antitrust issue, and that affected the advertising, but it didn't affect this core statement, which it seems to me, again, it seems anachronistic. It's sort of quaint 1950s-ish lingo, but it's got a resonance that, you know, we ought to think about, at least, or at least people in the media. I would bet that most kids who graduate from the Annenberg School at USC never even seen this, never even read it, never even thought about it. And I think if we even just put it in front of their face and had them debate its virtue, would probably be a good thing.
I'm gonna call on Steve Roberts in a second, but I just want to say where this came out of. It's interesting listening to Charlie's point on this, because he's absolutely correct, and he's really one of the leading experts on media and communications in the United States. But I will tell you, forget about the fact that I've worked in this field for 20 years. I have four kids, and I teach kids. And the idea that the thing that they spend most, that the greatest amount of their lives consuming, has zero sense of ethical norms whatsoever, and that anything goes based on your individual decision is almost mind-boggling to me. And we didn't say, when Zeke and I started out thinking about this, we did not say there was an easy answer, and there clearly is not an easy answer, which makes it such an interesting field. But there has to be some serious debate and discussion about this when our kids are doing this. We are now working at Common Sense a great deal with News Corp, because they own MySpace. And one of the most interesting issues there is to look at the way they view the MySpace issue, which, of course, if you are a parent of a young person today,
I'm not sure they know what MySpace is.
Everybody knows what MySpace is, right? It is the leading social networking site with about 70 million registered users today, where young people and old people, if they choose to, can basically reveal anything they want about themselves to an audience, which is like, it'd be like putting a naked picture of yourself on a billboard on Highway 101 and having it up there for a year or two. But the point is, there have to be some ethical norms, some sense of values that people can turn to. And I include the people who founded and run MySpace, because there is nothing they can turn to. And it is our job as a society to at least give some direction to this issue. Steve.
I wanted to build on something that Howard said, because I think that your conceptual framework is an important one. Teaching journalistic ethics, I grapple with the absence of a professional system. There's no certification. There are no, if you're a surgeon and you mess up, you got to go before the hospital board. If you're a journalist and mess up, you don't have anything like the same sanctions as let alone if you're a TV producer and produce a show that turns kids into axe murderers. So it is a much harder problem to do it in the media with, and in some ways, of course, that reflects the strength of the media, because as you pointed out, Zeke, one of the, in my view, the five difficulties you mentioned, the single biggest in some ways, is the First Amendment and the tradition of independence, which is at the very lifeblood of a healthy media. So you have to deal with the tension between the very strength and spirit of an independent media, which is what we want, and a media which is responsible, but the responsibility has to, I think, in many ways come from inside rather than from outside. And that's been my experience teaching media ethics. And one of the things that I would, you talk about News Corp. I think there are several pressure points where an effort to inculcate ethical thinking can come. You mentioned at the Annenberg School, the kids don't know this code. They should. I mean, there are relatively few people who go into the media who actually study the media in college, but at least that's one place to start. When we created at GW, they asked me about 4 years ago, what's the one thing our media students have to know before they graduated? We created a senior seminar in ethics, so that everybody who graduates has to take a course in ethics. Well, it's not. There are three things that are important about that. One is the message that's sent to them that this is the most important thing you have to know before you get out of here. The second thing is a way of thinking. We don't have them memorize codes of ethics. It goes back to the discussion, that fascinating discussion yesterday about the role of the university in inculcating civic and social and moral responsibility that a number of us were at. A lot of that discussion is about the interaction between professors and students, and how do you inculcate not a code, but a way of thinking. A, to take morality and ethics seriously. B, to equip people with a mechanism, an intellectual mechanism, for thinking their way through these problems. And so one place to start is in every single university, whether it's Annenberg, whether it's Maxwell at Syracuse or whatever, that there should be a campaign to say there should be a course in ethics in every single one of these schools. But then the second thing that I think is a lot of, as the certainly in the journalistic world, there could be a model. A lot of people are realizing that the need for mid-career ethical training, that there has been so many egregious examples of people in the media with responsibility not operating in an ethically sound way, that you have, for instance, the Committee on Excellence in Journalism, Bill Kovich and Tom Rosenstiel, have taken a group of retired journalists, and they are now teams of ethical trainers who go out around the country to news organizations giving seminars, very much the kind of seminar I give to undergraduates, but doing this at mid-career. Is there a model there for a place like News Corp, where you have, so because there are these two benefits, one, the signal that this is important,
right,
and B, equipping people individually, as you say, Charlie, with the mechanisms for thinking through ethical issues.
Steve, I think that is a great point. And the thing, as we've begun to look at this, as I said, this is not easy. And there may not be some formal code that can ever be written that you must adhere to. But we certainly must be emphasize exactly what you said, Steve, there about the simple importance of this and ways that we can begin that discussion.
Just a couple of things. First of all, I'd love to hear from Steve. Why do you teach them about their responsibility to truth and truth finding as opposed to presenting all sides of the story? I'd love to know what you teach them about that. And going back to the issue of television advertising, there was a major moment when we had to decide whether drug companies could advertise prescription drugs to children, especially mind-altering prescription drugs. And I wrote a lot about that. And I'd love us to discuss that as an example of advertising that can have huge impact on our children's brains. I mean, the science is really out on what impact it has on children's brains, putting them on Prozac or any kind of serotonin uptake, and I'd love to know what you think. And the fact that that you can advertise, sometimes it's disguised, it's not presented as being for children, but you can see the way the artwork is, the way the wording is, that it's really for children. Why are we allowing that when we really do not know what the impact on their growing brains is, and when there are very troubling findings, in fact, that have not been challenged?
Well, actually, one of the examples Jim and I have used is this: the advertising of Zoloft on kids' television does seem to be one of these things where you would want to say no, right? I mean, if you think there's a virtue to direct-to-consumer advertising, it clearly has to be to adults who can make a decision and then go to the doctor. You know, we don't think kids have this independent judgment and why we would permit that advertising. And I think the other point you mentioned, the sort of use of cartoon characters in lots of other cases, and again, if you look through videos, you look through online, the use of cartoon characters where the messages are very adult about sex, about drug use, and yet the medium, the cartoon character, is meant to appeal to young kids. This, again, is an area where I think the standards ought to be pretty clear. I don't think there's going to be a lot of disagreement about that. Now, maybe someone will say that there's some artistic freedom in merging these media, and there might be a case in some instances. But I think as a general rule, it's probably something that we should object to.
Two other points. Both Charlie Firestone and Steve brought up the First Amendment, which is not exactly a minor issue in the context of can we develop some set of framework of media ethics. And again, at Stanford, I teach civil rights and civil liberty. So I've been teaching First Amendment law for the last 20 years. And at Common Sense, we are the folks who brought the legislation in a variety of states, including California, signed by Arnold Schwarzenegger, against the video game industry to stop the sale of ultra-violent and sexually violent video games to kids under the age of 17. And by the way, there are very interesting First Amendment issues involved in that. But the one thing that I think is very important for people to understand is that when you look at First Amendment case law, and Charlie knows it probably better than I do, but I know it quite well, it is a balancing act. And the First Amendment, as critical as it is to everything that this country stands for and that we all believe in and that journalists and other great creators in the media and entertainment industry live under, it is a balancing act. There are other interests in society that need to be balanced with that. And it is very clear under the case law that particularly when children are concerned and where there are clear harmful effects on children, which is why Zeke and I are focused also on framing media as a public health issue for young people, that you must show, absolutely, you must show scientific proof of the impact on children. But once you do that, and they're in multiple fields now, that kind of evidence is there, then you balance the First Amendment concerns. But this is a very tricky area, Charlie.
I don't want to be identified as an absolute First Amendment. I was posing the challenge. You have a challenge there. I think one of the, so really where I was shortcutting to was how do you enforce? You come up with these ethics. What is your means of enforcement? Is it a code that, from the guilds? I think one of the things that really would help, it sort of follows on Steve's point about going out with media ethics courses, is kind of exposing to, in a way, a shame, the people who are the worst offenders. And sort of because everybody in whatever community you're in, you want to be respected. And if you can in some way
be having public displays of that this is the person who brought us Grand Theft Auto and has people, you know, in video games, has your kids shooting, you know, killing people at the rate of 30 people a minute, that, you know, might be something along the lines. But I think you have to think about how do you enforce, and particularly with respect to government.
Well, two things. One is, at least as we've conceptual, again, this is a conceptual discussion that we hope will evolve into a field. And we actually, Steve, have thought a lot about the fact that we need the communication schools, the film schools, any school that is teaching in the broadly defined area of media, communications, and entertainment to begin to adopt this. That was our idea, that it would spread. Jeff Cowan at Annenberg has been a colleague in this from the beginning. But it strikes me, actually, Charlie, in response to what you're saying, that there may not necessarily be an enforcement mechanism, that this much may more be the kind of thing that, Steve, that I'm sitting looking at Sidney Pollack back in the back of the room and thinking, what if some of the folks who've been really major figures in the entertainment industry, because I really care a lot more, quite frankly, as much as I care about the journalism issues that Ariana and Steve and others have brought up, I care about the entertainment industry, because kids are basically consuming a heck of a lot more of broadly defined entertainment content than they are of news content. You guys here may be consuming news content, but they're consuming entertainment content. Sometimes, unfortunately, they don't know the difference. But some of many of the news people don't know the difference last time I checked. But why isn't, you have to, in my opinion, you have to expand this to the entertainment industry. And by the way, I now include Google, Yahoo, MSN, and others as broadly defined entertainment content for kids. They're certainly delivering entertainment content to young people and to those of us who are no longer young people. And how do we do that? And why aren't there? And I don't know you, Sydney, but I know who you are. And it's like, why aren't there people who are senior citizens, if you will, of the entertainment industry recommending some of the same stuff? And is there, because I do think it will ultimately maybe not enforceable, but it has to come from the industry. I actually believe that this could never evolve in a meaningful way, nor did it evolve in a medical or legal context, if the industry itself on some level doesn't say this is a huge deal and there has to be an ongoing discussion of this.
Stand up and scream.
Just yell at us, Annie.
I have enough trouble knowing what to say to my kids, let alone figuring out what to say to a group like this. There's
a panel this afternoon where I'm sure we're going to get into this. It's a minefield. It always has been a minefield. The problem is not that we all who make movies, I can't speak for everybody, but I can certainly speak for the people that I deal with, understand and know precisely what you're talking about. It is a huge bully pulpit that you have. You have a very influential instrument in your hands. You can affect people radically. The minute that you're, I won't say manipulating, but appealing to and toying with feelings and emotions, you're going to change the pattern of thinking of people. It just works that way. Nobody feels it doesn't. The problem becomes, and I hope this doesn't sound like an excuse, the problem becomes that the real aesthetic part of the business end of movie making, believe it or not, the best part of it is almost unconscious. It's the creative part of it, which you can't work at consciously. You can work at craft consciously, and I suppose if you're a producer, as a producer, you're verbalizing and you're appealing to people and you're choosing those projects. Once you start to work on a film, you're hoping that you're going to find the oil in yourself, which is the creative part of it, and that doesn't respond so well to dictums. What you end up with, and what we've all seen in, let's say, countries where there are totalitarian governments or where there are governments that regulate these industries, are beautifully made and soporific movies. Boring beyond belief because they're essentially propaganda. The problem here is that I don't believe you can start by wanting to do good. You get pretentious and preachy. You just can't. You have to start by entertaining. And the rest comes out of the human being that's doing the entertaining. So I don't know what we do about that. I'm not against some sort of regulatory body, but, you know, I once did a film about the press where I got killed, you know, and it's appreciated much more now than it was at the time that I did. It was the first film that really dared to say the press isn't always holy, you know, and the press went crazy. And there was no conclusion at the end of it except to say, no, I don't want you to regulate it, but you either have to do it better or get better people to do it. Now, I don't know how you regulate getting better people to do it. I know this sounds like double talk, but it's a difficult question to answer. It really is.
I'd actually like to ask Jim Wallis, who is here. I see, who is a great theologian, after all, and has been grappling with these issues of morality and spirituality, because we're talking about something that ultimately goes back to the human being. Even if there is a codified set of rules, in the end, as Sidney said, you're not going to have a set of dictums. You are hoping that the creative people, the entertainment people, the news people are going to have enough of their own sense of ethics and morality to bring those to everything they do. So how do we cultivate that? I'd like to ask Jim that question, since I see him having finished his breakfast in the audience. And I'd just like to make one more point, which is, when we talk about consuming entertainment, consuming news and current affairs is also incredibly troubling. What makes, for example, Larry King put the story of the missing girl in Aruba on the show dozens of times? I remember it was some astonishing amount of times. And you wonder, what is it about it? It's a personal tragedy. It is not a collective tragedy. I would like to, in that code of ethics, whenever you get it, I'd like to have a footnote that says, please go call Turkey on the stories. That's what I do. I actually do not know what happened. I wear my badge of ignorance with pride, because it drains us. It's like this most voyeuristic, appalling way that we move from the Michael Jackson trial to the missing girl in Aruba to the whatever was the guy who killed the other blonde girl. And you know, as somebody called MSNBC, has become blondes reporting on missing blondes. So what is it about all that, Jim, all that over to you?
We have about four more minutes.
Okay. Well, let me say, as a dad and a Little League baseball coach, I've got a three-year-old and a seven-year-old, and I really applaud some of the comments made about that. When I'm on the stump, one line that I often say that gets a deep response is that in America, parenting has become a countercultural activity. And all parents nod their heads, whether they're liberal or conservative. And so the idea of this being a right-wing issue is a myth. It's a parent issue. And so I'm not sure Cindy the answer is either, but it certainly is vexing. The other thing that Arianna raised about the truth question, you know, I'm on TV a lot, and I got to tell you, those pre-interviews that they do, all they are is auditions to see if the talking heads have enough conflict to make for good television. The idea that every issue has only two sides, when you think about it, is really crazy. Take an issue I care about, youth violence. Does youth violence really have a right and a left, two opposing? No, there are multiple stakeholders, multiple perspectives, constituencies that you have to get to get at the truth. So getting at the truth is very different than making sure two sides are represented. How do we do that is going to be a big, big challenge for us.
Thank you, Jim.
Yes, back there in the red.
Stand up.
Discussion in another context for a moment. There is the issue of developing and writing and creating a code. There's a question of introducing it and having it adopted. The question of enforcement, it's a non-question. You're not going to enforce. Okay? But if you take a business approach of a company that says, I want to make a profit, well, you make a profit by first getting to break even, then making a small profit, and becoming a little more successful. And so I think that the concept here is not the great step forward. It's the progressive step forward. It's the voluntary adoption. It's the labeling, as it were, of a program, a newspaper, a reporter that says I subscribe to that may make some progress.
I think that's a very good point. And actually, Sydney, when you were referring to sort of a regulatory body, in our early exploration of us, our sense has been that it may not be possible to create a regulatory body, but it is certainly possible to create broad frameworks and statements of ethical norms that apply to media and entertainment that could have a profound effect without ever having to have a regulatory enforcement body.
Well, let me, for those of you who don't know, in medical ethics, there's no regulatory body for medical ethics. Most of the ethical decisions you do are never reviewed by some outside body. Right? You don't get generally disbarred for having, you know, not gotten informed consent in this case. You don't get thrown out of the profession. So the enforcement mechanism, I do think, is a separate issue. Part of what we want to do is actually put the issue on the agenda. And part of our sense is, at least in the broad media, it's not on the agenda. I mean, do people at News Corp or at Disney say to themselves, you know, what are the ethical implications? I guarantee you they ask, what are the financials? What's the ROI on doing this, right? What we want to say is not only should they ask what's the ROI, they should ask what are the ethical implications simultaneously. And that, I think, would be a dramatic cultural change. I once went to a health plan in Columbus, Ohio, where it was run by a bunch of sisters. It was a Catholic plan. And the head sister was this real tough battle axe, and she, you know, ran this thing for a profit so that she could give free care to lots of people who couldn't afford it. And every decision they made, they got the chief financial officer up there to justify how much money they were going to make. But they also had an ethics person who said how this coheres with their underlying values. And something which didn't cohere with their underlying values had to be adjusted so it did cohere with their underlying values. If the News Corp did that, if GE did that with NBC, I think we would have a dramatically different thing. They would actually ask a question, which I now venture to say never even gets asked.
And Sydney, I actually think this goes to the point you were making, because we have never thought this relates to the creative person, you as the film director. It's to News Corp who distributes your film. You can go create whatever you want to create in this society, and you, including snuff porn films if you want. Which you have not done, thankfully. But it's not you. It's not going to the creator. It's going to the distributor, the producer, but most of all, in our vertically integrated media world, the distribution company. And there can be a broad field of ethics that applies there that still protects the creative process and respects that wonderful explanation you gave of how creators create in the first place. One more question? No? Okay, we will stick around. Zeke and I and Ariana are happy to stick around. And by the way, this began here at the Aspen Institute, actually, and it is a discussion that we hope will evolve into a much bigger discussion for all. So thank you very much for joining us, and we're going to happy to stick around and talk some more about it. Thanks, Charlie.